This is a recording from CSIS. To help us improve our content, please take our short survey located at csis.org/survey. You could win an iTunes gift certificate.
Okay, I think it would be, I think we can go ahead and get started. It's great to see such a big crowd here, but I know it's not for me. I'm David Pumphrey. I'm the Deputy Director and Senior Fellow with the Energy and National Security Program here at CSIS, and it's always a great pleasure to have my good friend, I was going to say old friend, but I don't know that's the right term, Faridun, friend of long standing, Faridun Feshiraki, here to talk with us. And it's been really interesting. This is, I think, the fourth time that we've had you here, and I think the crowd gets bigger every time. So it's really great. You can tell that everyone is very interested in what you have to say. Faridun's biography, for those of you who don't know him, and I think most of the crowd here does know him, is available. And I think it's really a remarkable history from his early days in the Iranian government to then moving to Hawaii and starting a energy program looking at Asia in particular and trying to penetrate into the midst of the energy policy circles, and really moving that into a very successful consulting business that looks worldwide. So I think that your knowledge and experience will benefit us today. The topics for Faridun's conversation were China and India's energy policy directions with a little bit of discussion about Iran. And this came about after we tried to narrow down on what we should have Faridun talk about, because there's so many things. So I would encourage you, if you have any questions on energy globally, go ahead and think those up, too, and we'll hit him with additional questions in the Q&A. So with that, Faridun, why don't you please.
Thank you very much, Dave. I'm very happy to be here. I was told, you know, Washington is a town of cynics, so unless you give lunch to people, they don't come. But I am very impressed that so many of you have turned up. My job is to entertain you and amuse you and give you a few facts in between. The topics are very wide, and we were just talking that, you know, I have 47 slides here, and if I want to go through each of them one by one, you'll be here until 6 p.m. So I will jump across them, and I try to sort of compare and contrast India, and I'll talk about a little bit about what they are doing in Iran. And as Dave said, you should feel free to ask questions on any topic, as long as it's not about specific retail stations in Arizona. I should be able to be able to say something. Let me first start by saying that something about, you know, comparing China and India from the perspective of an analyst. If we look at the incremental growth for oil demand in the world, and also for natural gas, you have three countries, three areas standing up to show the power to you. Number one is China, and the annual growth in China has been significant. We expect it to remain in the 400,000 barrels per day a year incremental growth over the next 8 to 10 years, and then significantly slow down, and I'll tell you why. After China is not India, actually, it's the countries of the Persian Gulf. Persian Gulf countries, they grow by about 300,000 barrels per day a year, 250,000 to 300,000 barrels per day, and India about 100,000 to 150,000 barrels per day. So China and India should not surprise you. They're big countries, they're growing countries and dynamic economies. But the countries in the Persian Gulf are, add them all together, you know, sort of even including the large population country like Iran, they're still pretty small. But why are they growing so fast? It's because the price of oil is next to nothing. And the incomes are high, and the population 70% under the age of 30. So sort of a dynamic criteria for a massive growth in energy demand. But in China and India, it is very much, I think, the industry, the economy, and the way that the system is organized, which is leading to the growth. So India about a 30 to 40% of the Chinese growth rate is what we expect. The systems are set up in relatively similar ways. There are multiple national oil companies in both countries. These national companies are very rich and very powerful. In China, the three state oil companies this year are expected to make $45 billion of net profit. I mean, that will put to shame a lot of the big companies. They don't have to pay taxes. They don't have to give the money to the government. They keep the money. As long as they can invest it properly, the government let them keep it. And this is why you find a great deal of aggressiveness and brave strategies in going international acquisition as well as domestic expansions. India, similar, but smaller scale, much smaller scale. But you have very aggressive activities by India, except that the Indian companies, they don't make that amount of money. And some of them, in fact, are have to be subsidized because of the losses they suffered in the downstream sector, retail sector. Both countries kept the prices below the international market for a long time. China came out of that. And in fact, in China, there is a schedule that unless the price of oil goes above $130 a barrel, the government will not intervene to fix the prices. But above $80, there are moderation systems in place. But you can still have higher prices for petroleum products, even at above $80 crude. Both India and China have undertaken significant reforms. Last month was an amazing month. India and China both have raised the price of natural gas substantially. But India has doubled the price of natural gas from the administered pricing mechanism, the APM, cheap prices they had. And they have raised the price of petroleum products to the point that in China and India today, gasoline prices are above the at around the international prices. So they have done substantial actions to try to bring things in balance with the world market. So in China, the oil companies drive government policy. In India, the government drives the oil company policies. So the state companies, the big giants which operate in these two countries, are not the same. The Chinese ones are much more powerful and much stronger. If they want something really done, they will put it, couch it in the terms of security, and they will pull the government with themselves, who will use their muscle to sign the contracts on their behalf. In India, the government has to tell the companies what to do. So the roles are not quite the same. The Chinese are much more powerful in the area. The provincial authorities in China are a lot more powerful than the provincial authorities in India. But the direction and the importance of both of the countries remain the same. So again, as I mentioned, this is going to be available from CSIS. And I'm not going to go through every chart. I will jump on across very fast. But I wanted to show you just a few things. One thing is that don't count, hold your breath about a significant reduction in coal use in China. It still remains very large, though it's taken a big change from 70% to 60%, and we expect it probably to go down to 50%. But coal remains very important. Gas is slated for massive increases, both by domestic production as well as through imports, where China has now become a big, important global player as far as gas is concerned. Oil remains important. The growth rate for oil in China will be sustained for the next many years. But there is a huge debate in China today about bringing oil demand under control. In fact, it's the number one issue, to my mind, today, of how to create peak demand in China. And I think that is coming. The government has mooted now 12.5 million barrels per day as a ceiling for oil demand in 2020, and to keep it that way. And, of course, you can't be precise about these things, but they are a determined lot. So when they want to do something, I believe they have the tools at their disposal to bring the demand very close to what they are hoping. So they certainly, we have moderated significantly our forecast of the demand growth in China. You know, the economists, and I am guilty of that, Forecasting demand is very easy. Just give me 2 points of history of GDP and one elasticity, and I'll forecast anything for you. Don't ever ask me where the supply comes from, because that's not my job. It's the geologist. So forecasting demand growth in China has become a bit of a stupid game, I think, that people just have this incredible growth rates going on forever. So China becomes bigger than the U.S. and becomes double the size of the U.S. If everybody in China drives a car, then everybody in the U.S. has to walk. There is not enough oil in the world to accommodate some of these forecasts. But the people who do the forecast, they don't actually care about where the supply comes from. So whoever does forecasting for you anywhere, please tell him, show me where the supply comes from. Hold them to it. And in case of China, the Chinese government understands that. That is why they realize that if they keep growing, their own action will make sure that the price of oil goes up and the energy security will be in trouble. So because of that, they have taken deliberate measures. And they are taking deliberate measures to try and bring the demand under control. So maybe they cannot do it at 12.5, maybe it'll be 13 or 14. Maybe the growth rate will not be zero, be only 50,000 barrels per day. But it is a high priority issue, and it's something that I believe they intend to do and they can do. And it should enter our calculations as we look at the future of demand in China. This is the who is who of the Chinese oil industry. A complicated story, but actually quite logical. You can see the big boys. This is the CNPC PetroChina, CNOOC, and Sinopec. Then you have the fourth one, Sinochem, China Oil here, and Unipec are the trading arms of Sinopec and CNPC. This is a company, Zhenrong, which is only authorized to buy oil from Iran. This company is only formed for trading with Iran. Now, because other companies objected, anything more than 250,000 barrels per day that they purchase, after they buy 250,000 barrels per day, then other Chinese companies can also approach Iran for volume. But before that, you cannot. And so many people ask the question, well, the Chinese are working in Iran to bring volume to China. Actually, if the Chinese company works in Iran, what they produce will have to go to Zhenrong, not to them. And this is a company which came from the military, is now registered as a civilian company, and it is a very important player. And it has a mandate for the first 250,000 barrels per day imports to be done through them. The government here is represented by, let me see, cannot make this move, oops. Okay, now I can make a move. NDRC, National Development Reform Commission, and the NEC, NEO, these are the government apparatus in there which report to the Council of Ministers or State Council. But essentially, you have these giant enterprises which are very powerful and very strong and very rich. And they are both the tools of the state, and the state is the tool of them. The principle, in my view, is that the survival of the enterprise is more important than the state. So first, you focus on these companies. And the state is there to support them being very successful and being globalized. And I will come and tell you how much oil they control around the world today. This is what I told you about the profits of the Chinese companies. These guys are really, really rich, put to shame many of the international majors. I told you about demand, 6 or 7% growth, but this is expected to slow down significantly. I don't want to talk too much about refining capacity. The Chinese policy essentially is, I don't want to export, I don't want to import. But since I don't want to import, I may do too much exports. So some volume may go out of the country as balancing, but huge amount of capacity has been built in China, and a huge amount is under construction. So we don't expect China to become a huge exporter of petroleum products because they don't want to. They just want to make sure that they produce enough for themselves. Now, I will tell you, India is very different. India has become a hub of refining exports. Today, India exports more refined products than Saudi Arabia. That may come as a surprise to you, as a Singaporean, which is the trading hub of the Asian market. But India is number one. That is part of a different kind of thinking and different kinds of policy. But China still builds a lot. A lot of the people who supply technology, manufacturing, are very keen. But the Chinese use mostly their own technology they developed themselves during the years they were cut off. And their technology is pretty good. The level of sophistication of the Chinese refinery is only second in the world after the U.S., a lot more than it is in Japan or most of Europe. Oil product prices, I mentioned to you, they have managed a system now that as long as the prices are under $80, you can sell at the market level. Now, they will tell you what the market level is, but they're very, very close approximation to the market. Between $80 to $100, they have some level of control, between $100 to $130, a bit more control. After $130 oil, they keep the price flat. This is the current regulation. But in China, for a period of time, the companies were losing a lot of money because the price of oil was, when it was $147, they kept it as if it was $80. And the government companies which lost money, end of the year, received a check from the government. And they were kept whole, but they had to wait a whole year for it. They didn't like it. Some of them started to export and left the domestic market not supplied. The government was not pleased. Put their foot down. You can't export until you make sure the domestic market is supplied. But there is a sort of happy arrangement between the government and the oil companies. There is no big tension. There is no big sort of conflict. More conflict in India than in China, particularly India, because there is a robust and strong private sector operating. So the system has worked more and more moving to the free market. And contrary to everybody's expectation, this is going to slow down the demand. It hasn't happened. The demand is about the same as it was before, almost unchanged at about 400,000 or 500,000 barrels per day growth a year, which scares the Chinese government itself, who they want to see some level of control there. Let me talk about where the Chinese get their oil. The Middle East is almost 50%, and Africa is 30%. Africa is very important because of, number one, Angola, and then Sudan. Now, why do the Chinese like Angola very much? Because Angolan crude is very much very similar to Chinese crude. It's heavy and it's sweet, and it fits the Chinese refineries very well. This last 2 weeks, China even, the imports from Angola has gone higher than Saudi Arabia. But essentially, this always Saudi Arabia is number one, Angola is number two, and Iran is number three. That's how the system's kind of designed to. And volumes going to Angola is imported by CNPC PetroChina, because they are the ones which are owners of the refining system, which can handle heavier, sweeter crude. What comes from Saudi Arabia, Iran, Kuwait, Iraq goes mostly inside the Sinopec system, which is designed to handle sour crudes. Now, you would say, well, why would Venezuela want to say to sell heavy crudes to CNPC PetroChina, since they don't have a system to handle crudes? So that sort of shows, a level of lack of understanding of who is who in China and what the companies do. Because CNPC was in upstream business in Venezuela, that was seen to be by Venezuela to be the obvious choice. But actually, CNPC and its public affiliate, PetroChina, are the least able to handle the sour crudes. The ones who can handle it very well are the people in Sinopec. And there is no the Chinese concept. If you deal with this group, the other group is not going to deal with you. So as a result of this, you really need to get large volumes from Venezuela into China. You need to have dedicated refinery built. And that is the plan, you know, build a $10, $12 billion, 400,000 barrels per day refinery. So you can make it work, but there are a massive associated cost and de facto discounts which have to come to the system. So the volume they get from Russia is also significant, but they get oil from Russia by train. It's amazing. These dedicated trains which just go from one spot to another spot. And so this is roughly their system, and it's highly unlikely that this level of buying in terms of the relationships change. As the growth comes, the same kind of people will be expected to supply. Saudi Arabia will go to 1 million barrels per day, I expect, within the next 3-4 years, when they are likely to take a partnership or a special arrangement with the Qingdao refinery in the northeast and supply 200,000 barrels per day dedicated to that too. Essentially, Saudi Arabia becomes unchallengeable in the system, and now the Saudis have invested, together with ExxonMobil, in the refinery in Fujian province, which is already in operation for more than a year and a half. When we look at the outlook for imports, they will buy a lot more as time goes by. As we see their production as flat, not changing. So any kind of growth would have to go towards imports. So they become a bigger and bigger player as time goes by. In terms of the oil imports, you have potential of a refining surplus because they're building the refineries assuming the demand will come. But at the same time, they're putting their foot on the brake on the demand side. So that may end up giving them a surplus refineries. But as of now, the policy is that we don't want to export. We will export what we have to as a balancing, but it is not a strategy for us to be in the product market. The strategic petroleum reserves, the three phases. Phase one, which ended in 2008, 103 million barrels, 31 days of net imports, and 15 days of total consumption in the four sites, already completed, and all the tanks were filled. They waited for the price of oil to go down, and then they started to buy. The Chinese are very much sensitive to being accused of being a reason for the price of oil goes up. And of course, you know, many people want to blame somebody. Used to blame OPEC and Saudi Arabia, but now blame the Chinese. Went up. Nobody says the reason the price of oil goes up is because I'm consuming too much oil myself. I should cut it back myself. And if anybody mentions taxes, I'll try to assassinate him. So it is really sort of, the Chinese are so sensitive. And they just want to wait until they see a lull in the price of oil before they start buying. And, you know, the other day when the IEA said China has become the largest energy consumer in the world, immediately they disputed IEA. No, I'm the second. U.S. is first. I don't want to be the first here. This is a sort of a bad position to be in. They don't mind being better than the Japanese or bigger than the Koreans. That's fine. But they don't want to be bigger than the U.S. The U.S. has to be the biggest one first so we can not pass the blame to us. Target phase two, 2012, this is 170 million barrels, which brings the total to 272. 60 days of imports and 30 days of total consumption. This one, half done. And the phase three, 2015-16, is to come up to total of 500 million barrels of SPRs, which is what they intend to do, and I believe they will achieve it. But their buying is going to be very much affected by the price of oil. They don't want to be accused. The price of oil is going up. You started buying from them. That's why you've pushed the prices up. They don't want to be blamed for that. This is the Chinese companies, how much oil they own around the world. This is the equity position. And here are different players. And you can see, of course, in the blue is PetroChina, number one, of course, in China and around the world, and the big upstream player. They own most of the assets. And number two in the green is Sinopec. And CNOOC is in red, and others, including Sinochem, are above. So as of 2009, almost 1.2 million barrels per day of equity owned they own around the world. which I must tell you that it's a remarkable achievement. After 40 years, the Japanese could not come to 1/6 of that level. And in Korea, where there is a major effort by Korea National Corporation on the way, I think when they are 300,000 barrels per day would be sort of pretty much the likely upper ceiling in the near term. But China is 1.2 already. And the different players, this is not the kind of service contracts that they have in places like Iran. This is actually equity oil. So very substantial. Now, where will this number go? Based on existing agreements signed, this would be about 1.5 million barrels per day by 2015. So it's a significant, even by international standards. And it comes from a strategy of acquiring what other people have found. The mistake in the Japanese strategy was to always try to find it yourself. And if you're not very good at it, then you can't find it. But let somebody else find it, and I'll just buy it. And I'll buy it for my $45 billion that if I don't spend, I may lose. So the Chinese policy has a great deal of logic inside it. And if it doesn't make sense to you, that's because you don't understand why they do what they do. But there is always a good reason for it. Every time I didn't understand it, I looked deep, and there was a good reason. So if you're going to go and look at the production of the Chinese companies between CNPC, CNOOC, Sinopec, you, of course, see that CNPC is number one, Sinopec number two, CNOOC outside, and, of course, Sinochem is emerging. And Sinochem is an oil trading company which now has refining assets and also upstream assets outside, storage assets. In China, it's very important for these companies to show themselves to be integrated. If they're not integrated, another of the big boys may gobble them up. Those of you who follow China might remember China National Star was one of our clients, a very successful company upstream. One morning, doesn't exist anymore, became part of Sinopec. You have to say, you have to have refining, petrochemical, upstream at home, upstream abroad, and LNG. Now, Sinochem still doesn't have LNG, so they just want to get their hands into something too, so that they are now earn a seat at the table for being integrated domestically and internationally. And of course, these are, you know, CNPC has 1.4 million employees. Sinopec is pretty small, 1.2 million employees. CNOOC is really lean at 600,000 people. So when they register these companies, publicly listed companies in Hong Kong and New York, you put the good assets and a small number of people. So CNPC put 400,000 people in the public listed company, PetroChina. And all of the sort of liabilities, social security system they have to provide, housing, medical, everything else, is put in the parent company. So whatever profit they make, of course, these activities will go to the parent company and gets dumped into the system that they're committed to do. But for the shareholders, the value is only of the good parts, good assets of the companies. Now, gas, I want to say a few words. In China, gas is growing, is very important, and is growing very, very fast. But starting with a very small role, 3.5% in 2009, used to be only 1% 8 or 9 years ago. And we are expecting it to go to anywhere between 7 to 9% in the 2020. So it's still a huge growth, much bigger than hydro or nuclear, but much smaller than oil and coal, of course. As we look towards the demand, sectoral demand, in China, the demand is industry, not power. Power is a secondary player. Residential and commercial are likely to come, but they have to build the pipelines and reticulation system that they don't have. But it is coming. Today, the residential sector can pay you $12, $14 a million BTU. The power sector cannot pay you much more than six. So if you want to buy gas in China, one of the state companies, they go to the government gives you permission to do whatever you want, pretty much. You can buy at the price you want, but you cannot sell at the price that you want. You have to sell it at the prices which are mandated by the government. And the government has raised the prices in June 25%. This is the second increase in 2 years. And they are intending to keep raising it all the time. it won't reach the oil price, which are pretty much at the oil market parity, but they have become very realistic about subsidizing gas. The power sector in China still has problems paying higher prices. Industrial sector can do better. Residential can do much better. But there is very, as you can see, very minor residential system in place. Now, outlook for LNG imports, this has a big impact on the global market, especially as some of the exporters like Qatar, they say, well, if you don't buy from me, I just sell to the Chinese. Well, in China, the base case that we have is still quite radical. It's about 40, 50 million tons of LNG. If you look at Japan being about 68 and probably looking at 75 or so, this is one thing that the Chinese will not overtake Japan. I mean, everything else already have overtaken, but in LNG imports, still I think Japan would be highest. Now, high case, they can go near Japan, and low case would be based on pretty much whatever they have contracted or committed today. So they have already committed a lot and contracted a lot. So since you can't fly this stuff in, you look at the terminals, policies, who is building. It's much easier to forecast in China and India than it is in other places, at least in the near term, because it takes so many years to build the terminal and the regasification facilities and develop the market. So this is our estimate that they will be a big player, but they would be second largest importer in the world after Japan, exceeding Korea and Spain as the third and fourth player. In the old days, we thought the U.S. would be the number one, but that is now sort of taking 100 years or 850 years delay. Okay, let me switch to India. India, fifth largest consumer of energy in the world, as compared to China, number two. Very powerful system, with again, heavily dominated by coal. But in coal in India, there's a story which is untold. It's that coal is controlled by a union which is similar to what Mexican oil unions used to be. They don't want anybody in the country. Okay, so because they don't want anybody in the country, they don't allow foreign investment in the coal sector. It is now clearly understood that if the foreign investment comes to the coal sector, coal production in India can go up a lot. But the government struggles with the sort of mafia-type unions who will really try to stop any development in India. I think things are changing. The changes will come, and there'll be more coal coming in India. But India is busy outside buying everybody's coal. I mean, every time these Indonesians want to sell something, there are 15 bidders and 12 of them are Indians. And they want to bring coal to India. So coal still remains very high on the radar in India, and they are very actively seeking worldwide acquisition of coal as much as they are looking for acquisition of oil. Now, this is the structure of the oil and gas industry in India. Different, you have the crown jewels on top. This is Oil and Natural Gas Corporation of India, Indian. This is upstream company, which has one refinery in Mangalore. You have the Indian Oil Corporation and the National Thermal Power Company in charge of the essentially most of the state-owned power sector in India. And then you have the blue ones, which are kind of secondary companies, government-owned. Hindustan Petroleum, Bharat Petroleum, Gas Authority of India Limited, and Oil India Limited, which is conveniently called OIL. These are all state-owned companies. HPCL and BPCL are downstream refining companies which now have substantial assets. BPCL has a huge position now in Brazil. They go international and trying to get assets. Everybody is there trying to buy upstream assets worldwide. And the government is in between. There are lots of smaller players, subsidiaries in India, which operate. And one of the interesting ones is Petronet, you can see on the left, which is owned by GDF International, Indian Oil, GAIL, and Hindustan Petroleum. These guys essentially are in charge of the importation of LNG. Into the main terminals. They are not the only ones, there's no monopoly, but they are the most important importer of LNG into India. The government has different titles for them. The established companies, the sort of smaller companies, and the mini companies. And these are the smaller players which are in India. But each of them very powerful. Now, in India, when the government controlled the price of oil and the companies were forced to lose money, unlike China, which gets a check at the end of the year, they got no check. They got a bond. And this is called the oil bonds. And these oil bonds have been issued for a number of years, now about $30, $40 billion of them. Essentially, the government says, I issued a bond, and the future generation will pay. And, you know, sort of the public, they don't like these bonds because they think that somebody may say one day, what the hell have you done, all this amount of money you generated? So what happens was that the market started discounting the oil bond up to 25%. So the Indian government stepped in, buying the bonds back by the Reserve Bank of India, just so they can sort of keep these companies whole. And of course, if you're a private company in India, then you have a big problem because you get no check from anybody. And this is why the big players like the Reliance people, they have been exporting and not selling in India, because selling in India is just a guaranteed loss. But the export market will pay you more. So these things, with the price increases which came in the past 2-3 weeks, a lot of these issues now have started a new game. Still, I think the international market is better, but by marginal amount. Only kerosene and LPG remain heavily subsidized, but most of the other products are at or near the market. Now, if the price of oil jumps up from $80, $75 to $100, there'd be a problem. But if it stays at these levels, I think the Indians will be moving to reach the international market very shortly. Demand growth in India is sort of growing very fast. 3 million barrels per day, total petroleum consumption in India. And the production of oil in India is very low, much, much smaller than China. And so imports become bigger and bigger as time goes by. Now, if we look at 2008 to April 2010, this is the time of the global recession, which did affect India, but the surge in diesel demand has been seen, where the consumption grew by 8%. Then, on the gas side, entry of Krishna Godavari Basin gas from the famous D6 gas field has become a very important player. It has reduced naphtha consumption alone by 16%, just this new gas field. And incidentally, that gas is priced by the government edict at the price of $4.20 at the landfall, which is just outside the offshore area, and is selling $7. So people paying a higher price for gas in India than people are paying in the United States. And actually, the same in China. People paying higher price for gas in China than they pay in the United States. So we move in, I think, substantially to try to bring the gas and oil prices together towards the international market, while in the U.S. we've seen the oil and gas prices divorcing and going away from each other in the U.S. market. Demand outlook for India, I think that we see a revival of industrial manufacturing center. The fiscal stimulus in China and India have been very successful. A lot of transition from lower to middle income class. You see, again, all of the issues that you expect. And of course, the 1 lakh rupee car, $2,000 car, which is, I've driven in it, and it's not very fast, but it does protect you from rain and kind of all of the negative air outside in Bombay if you want to be sitting in it. 600 cc's only, so it's sort of, it's a motorcycle with a box outside it. But for 2,000 bucks, it seems okay. Negative factors, again, some slowdown GDP growth rate. They haven't gotten to the issue of saying, I want to have a limit on my consumption yet. Substitution after by natural gas in fertilizer. And natural gas entry into India has changed the game in a big way. And it's a much more radical impact than the impact of things that we've seen in China. Improved efficiency in road transport. And fuel price reform, essentially, they are moving towards the international market. And I think that this is a very positive step on both sides. I think the impact on demand in India will be more severe than the impact of demand of the higher prices in China. Now, I told you about India becoming a one of the largest global refining markets. If the Indian growth rate is only 100, 150,000 barrels per day, they would be in surplus 15 more years. So a lot of the best refinery and the largest refinery in the world today is India. Who would have believed a refinery in India better than any refinery in the United States? And a lower cost and fantastic management by Reliance Industries Corporation. Of course, they expected to come and export to the United States before things kind of fell apart. And of course, remember the old days where people thought there's a huge refining capacity shortage in the U.S. and build the refineries in the military camps and, you know, sort of. Now, of course, everybody said, oh, these Americans, they can't make a refinery for themselves. So we build it and export it to them. And while everybody was ready to export, gee, we don't want it. We don't need it anymore. So part of the global surplus is the massive change which came in the United States itself. But India remains very big, and part of it encouraged by government. As government in India believes that energy security is improved by having too much refining capacity. I'm not sure why, because if you don't have the crude, you don't have the energy security. But there you have it. They are still building. Couple more major refineries still coming, and India becomes a powerhouse as far as the refining industry is concerned. This is a list of the key projects which is being done. This is all in the next 2-3 years. A lot of new refineries are being built. And there is the strong case for price reform. I mean, if you look at the amount of money the government has put in, $21 billion last year, and now we are looking at a smaller subsidy of $10 billion, still is substantial. This is that the target is to bring it to less than $5 billion and eventually eliminate it. So, and you can see in terms of the different products that the, of course, kerosene has been heavily subsidized, domestic LPG heavily subsidized, diesel heavily subsidized. Sort of gasoline, less of a subsidy they've received in terms of the total amount. But it has been across the board. And this, as I said, this recent price reform of June put that in a different context. Okay, overseas investment. ONGC Vidish, which is a subsidiary of ONGC in India, OVL, has now 40 assets in 16 countries. And the assets which are producing, including the Greater Nile oil project in Sudan, Block 5A, Block 6-1 in Vietnam, Al Furat in Syria. They are part of Sakhalin 1 consortium. They are all over the place, of course, also in Venezuela. And the place that they wanted to be, but they are not very active now, is in Iran. ONGC bought Imperial Energy of UK, and they're targeting 16 million tons of overseas oil and gas production. 60 million tons would translate to about 1.2 million barrels per day, which is what China has today. So what India wants to have in 2025 is equal to what China has today. And as I mentioned, IOC, HPCL, BPCL are involved in international activities. Iran and Nigeria's substantial effort has gone into it, but nothing very much has materialized. And India has followed China by setting a site on Africa and Latin America, as well as Russia. But Africa and Latin America are now very high on the list. But whenever they get into competition with China, they lose. And the losses in China come because in China, the companies, the state companies, they don't need to get, they need to inform the government about what they want to buy. They don't need permission. They have the money already. In India, everything they have to do, they have to ask. And so often it becomes a cabinet decision. By the time the cabinet says yes, Chinese have got in already. So in that kind of competition, it's very difficult for anybody to compete with China. But the system flexibility has been put in there to give them authority to move forward as long as they operate within these huge budgets that they have. Natural gas demand, India different than China. Power is driving natural gas demand, with industry being much cheaper, residential and commercial the same way. But in India, transportation of CNG gas has become very important. Any of you who have traveled in Delhi and Bombay, you will see the public transportation all by CNG. And I remember I was in Delhi on the day of transition, the day that they had to go to CNG from gasoline, and there were very few cars on the street. But one good thing about India, I don't know what the good thing or bad thing in India is, I don't want the same thing to be done in the U.S., but the decisions on environment are made by the Supreme Court. Okay? You go there, and they will rule, and there is no appeal, no discussion. Once they say it, you have to do it. And so there is a sort of terminal aspect of the decision. So when the government went and made appeals, and I was assisting the government, that this speed they wanted was too fast. They have to give it time. And we went to Supreme Court in India, and they said, we've already ruled. We just haven't announced it. So no need for you guys to make a presentation. And so we said, but this is not ready. This is all this. I have 300 transparencies and charts for you. They said, well, thank you very much. You can leave it with the clerk and register it, and decisions are made. So by George, they did it, and it worked. And it worked. The air in Delhi has improved significantly. And, you know, some sort of bit of force here or there may have its own value. In Bombay, it's been slower, but pretty much all public transport has gone CNG. This is not something which has happened in China. And, of course, the CNG, remember, was based on the cheap $2.50 million BTU administered price of gas. Now that gas has been raised to $5 as of 2-3 weeks ago. It's not so much fun anymore. Okay, now you have to end up giving a subsidy or somehow remove all taxes to make the CNG compete with gasoline. Of course, one of the largest CNG users in the world is Iran, where there are thousands of service stations. But if the price of gas is nothing, CNG is an easy decision. But if the prices are high, then you have to compare the oil market and make the decisions. Outlook for LNG imports, much smaller player than China, but a significant global player. We're looking at 15 million tons by 2020 and about 20-25 million tons afterwards. The sky is the limit. Again, remembering in China and India, if there is price of gas is cheap, there is no limit to demand. If the price of gas is high, there are lots of limits to demand. So when we do our analysis in China and India, we always do it under different price scenarios. So here, assuming the price of gas remains cheap, of course, if the price of gas is cheap and Indians buy it all, it becomes expensive. So it doesn't work that way. But the upper case could be very high. The upper case could be equal to the lower case or the base case of China. But India is an important player, and they have not paid any of the high prices for gas that China has paid. So they've been a lot more diligent in the negotiations over gas imports. Now, in terms of Iran, this is a list of activities which are done by China in Iran. Many activities. Most important role, of course, that China has today is actually not in the upstream sector. It's in the downstream sector. In upstream, they famously discussed about the so-called Azadegan field, which was managed, or the original contract was with INPEX in Japan, and INPEX still holds a 10% share nominally, although they have gone totally. But the INPEX plan was pretty clear. I mean, you can go up first phase within 3-4 years to about 150,000 barrels per day, then go up to 250. This is with access to all technology, plenty of money being spent, and you need about 7 years. So it isn't something that suddenly you can just produce a lot because now Chinese are there instead of the Japanese. It's just not done. So it is a high-cost, expensive. Azerbaijan has a 30 billion barrel reserve, but a recovery of only 4 billion barrels. So one of the lowest recovery factors in the world because of the great complexity and difficulty of production. So whether in the future technologies can get more out of it, maybe, but certainly at the moment, much smaller play. So the Chinese side, they have been active. And actually, they are really the only main players left in the country. Everybody else is gone. But the amount of contribution they have created for Iran in terms of exports, in terms of money, in terms of the prestige, is actually very, very small. Very small. But in terms of the downstream, Chinese activity Sinopec is now involved in development of one of the largest catalytic crackers in the world, in the Arak refinery, which is just outside of Tehran. This is around 85,000 barrels per day, 90,000 barrels per day cat cracker, together with the joint venture with the Iranian consultants, very competent. And I understand firsthand that this project is more than 70% complete. And by the end of 2011, it will be operational, adding between 75 to 85,000 barrels per day to the production capacity of gasoline in Iran. Now, there are two other refineries in Iran which are also receiving catalytic crackers. One is in my hometown in Isfahan, and one is in Abadan. They will be finished by 2012 or 13, and combined, the Iranian gasoline production will go up by 200,000 barrels per day as a result of this. So sort of, I think the sanctions policy would have been much more effective a few years ago, not now. As you know, in Iran, there is a policy of smart cards, which gives a quota for each car. Now, I'll try to say the numbers so that you can, in an easy way, so that you can remember. In Iran, 65% of gasoline consumption is domestically produced, and 35% is imported. So one-third has been imported before. Now, each car is given a smart card, which gives them 100 liters per month access. And if you want more than 100 liters, you can buy it from the service stations outside of the smart cards, for which you pay international price of about 50 cents a liter as compared to 10 cents. A 500% price increase if you want to go in the outside of your quota. Okay? So when everything started, 96% of total consumption was subsidized and 4% was free market. Last year when I was here, I was predicting that the Iranian government is going to reduce that 100 liters to lower volume using the threat of sanction by the U.S. to justify their actions. So they went to 80 liters per car. And this, immediately we expected a lot of that will mean that people will buy the 20 liters extra from the free market. Well, they didn't. They just cut the waste. So it actually sort of increased efficiency. So the 4% went to about 6% or 7%. It almost doubled, but not substantially, because the rest of it is people just wasted because it was so cheap. And waiting desperately for the U.S. sanctions to be imposed on July 1, they reduced the sanction, they reduced the quota to 60 liters. So if your 100 liters was your mechanism before, now 40% of it is outside the subsidized rate. And if you have a two-third, one-third domestic production versus imports, it kind of tallies with that in a way. So now, 60 liters is the quota, and anything else you want to buy, you can buy with 500% premium. Well, the elasticities really work because the wastage is so large. In the month of July, the first 2-3 weeks of July, the imports in Iran has fallen by half compared to June. Of course, everybody can pat them on the back, themselves on the back, so I did it. It's because everybody is scared of me in the U.S. That's why they're not selling. Well, the Iranians, of course, have built huge inventory. But the fact is that the higher prices are reducing the demand themselves. And I am a firm believer that international sanctions cannot impact flow of gasoline. Gasoline will flow. Now, it may not be so easy. The big players all will give it to somebody else who will pass it on. You can't stop the flow of gasoline unless you put a naval blockade. Without that, it's not possible. For crude oil, it's much easier because only a few big buyers. But for gasoline, there are virtually thousands of suppliers. And all the big boys, we say, well, I'm not selling anymore. They're just selling to somebody else. And that somebody else can export to Iran or somebody else, to another country. We don't know. But the reality is that this move to a smaller quota is going to significantly cut the requirement. So I think the number has gone down. It will go up a bit later on. But I think the Iranian government would have saved several billion dollars in imports. And also, the air will be much clearer. The government will get a lot of credit for less traffic. This is the best thing which could have happened to Iran anyway, with or without the Ahmadinejad government. So the government was forced to do something which was the right thing for themselves, but as a result of an external threat, which could be used to allow that to happen. As strong as governments could have been in Iran or in Indonesia under President Suharto, you raise the price of gasoline and you lose your job. Now you can raise the price of gasoline and you keep your job because you are worried about somebody else who can be the sort of the reason for your actions. Again, Chinese companies are not only involved in the development of oil and gas, they are key suppliers of upstream equipment in Iran, and they face potential sanctions in that area. I mentioned about the Sinopec in Iraq and also the Persian Gulf Star, which is a condensate splitter. They haven't started building it yet because they're going to build this before because they needed to convert the condensate from the South Pars field to gasoline. But kind of is not so urgent anymore because the demand is disappearing and the domestic refineries are coming up fast enough with the catalytic crackers to reduce the import requirements. So essentially, China is still heavily involved in Iran. Most of what they do, they don't make any money from. And the assumption is that they go there to be able to get crude. The buyback contracts will give them some cash, maybe some crude. But if they sell crude, it's going to go to Zhenrong. It's not going to go to themselves because Zhenrong is the one which is authorized to import the first 250,000 barrels per day from Iran. India, a lot less relationship. Now, lots of people took credit for the U.S. government to persuade the Indian government not to buy natural gas from Iran. It was not the U.S. government. It was economics. Okay, if Reliance can produce the gas and sell it at $4.20 a million BTU at the landfall, and the customers hand by six, the Iranian gas would cost $13 plus in the Indian market. You have to be really crazy to go for that kind of deal. And the deal that Iran has signed with India, with Pakistan, and this is a firm deal. It's not a MOU. It's a firm sales and purchase agreement. Would give, at $80 oil, about $9 a million BTU gas to Pakistan. Extremely expensive. Extremely expensive. And then they wanted to add $2 for transit fee and plus something else extra on top of it to give it to the Indian border, and then they had to put it in the HPJ pipeline in India, which would have been atrociously expensive for the consumer. So it was economics which killed it, not arm twisting. The Pakistan deal still is on. Iran is not building a pipeline to supply Pakistan. Iran is building a pipeline to supply itself. It's a domestic pipeline which has been planned as IGAT-9 for decades, to bring the gas from Asaluye to Iran Shah, which is about 100 kilometers from the Pakistani border. And only the extension has to be built. And it's a 54-inch pipeline, so it can add 2 billion cubic feet a day of extra gas in it. But remember, Iran today is a net gas importer. And we think the net gas imports to Iran will be maintained even if Iran exports to Pakistan, because the additional requirements from Turkmenistan are there. And Iran is paying more to Turkmenistan in import of gas today than it can charge from Pakistan. So a lot of these things are for other reasons, right, than economics. I don't see Iran as a big gas exporter now or in the future, unless the domestic pricing system changes in a big way. And it's very difficult to see that. One thing I have to remind you, we all know that the U.S. is the largest consumer of gas in the world, and Russia is the second largest consumer. But Iran is the third largest consumer of gas in the world, bigger than China, bigger than anywhere else in Europe, bigger than Japan. On the back of 10 cents to 30 cents a million BTU gas. You can't raise it because you paralyze the economy and people will die. It is as a result of Mr. Shiraz is here. He, first instance, before the revolution, he built the gas pipelines. Gas pipelines you build in the country were continued ferociously by the Islamic Republic. When you build it, you can't change the price anymore. You have to keep it. Because if you change the price, you create an implosion in the economy. So with the best of intentions, the government is hostage to bad macroeconomic policy. And oil you can change, but gas you cannot. So in terms of the involvements, ONGC, IOC were kind of fingers were shaken by the U.S. government. Reliance got fingers shaken at them too. But Reliance did not renew his contract with an IOC. They have disagreements over buying of the heavy crudes from Iran also. But the activities which are undertaken, both China and India, as a sanction-busting activities, are pretty minor in the scheme of things. Really pretty minor. And, if we see the Iranians importing energy, you can't say, it's your fault. No, you have to begin to question the policy itself rather than the other people who are trying to bust it. And I think that when you put everything together, for Chinese, I think it's more sort of psychological, minor returns, and they need to be connected to resource owners. But how much money they make, what they get out of it, is very small. And India has pretty much checked out. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Feridun. That was great and comprehensive, and so we really appreciate you taking the time to walk through all those issues. I'd like to open it now for some questions. We have a couple of rules here at CSIS. One is if you would please identify yourself and your affiliation, and then also if you could make sure that when you end up whatever statement you're making, it has a question attached, that would be helpful as well, unless you'd like to start an argument that I'm sure Feridun would engage in that as well.
Constructive criticism is also welcome.
Oh, okay. And I actually I wanted to note that I like your comment about being hostage to bad macroeconomic policy. I think it's a lesson perhaps many other countries in the world could learn to be aware of. One thing I was going to ask you about to follow up was the potential role for unconventional gas resources in both of these countries. Obviously, it's changed the dynamics of the U.S. gas market. We're hearing more and more about China's exploration for shale gas and the potential there. India has tremendous coal deposits and potential for coal bed methane, and we're seeing for the first time coal bed methane in Australia being actually used to support an LNG project, which I would have never thought would have happened. So I was just wondering if you'd like to, if you have any comments on whether or not we can expect these resources to come into play in a major way, or maybe what the time frame for that is.
I think in China, coal bed methane already is huge and becomes bigger and bigger. I mean, we have very bullish forecast of coal bed methane inside of the Chinese system. In India, it's a little bit hostage to the same unions who don't allow foreign investment. If you produce more coal, then you have more coal bed methane. But if you don't produce the coal, then it's not there. I expect that it becomes bigger and bigger in India also. And now that coal bed methane, I mean, I think beyond the two of them, also Indonesia is a place without 200 TCF of coal bed methane could be available to them. So coal bed methane becomes a very, very important part of the total system. Now, In some shale gas, there are large geological areas in China which has shale gas. People are surprised that the Chinese are not rushing to do it. And actually, there is an official statement in China that we produce 2 BCF a day by 2015, which is absolutely impossible to do. Because, if they started a year ago, they couldn't do it. It's a timing issue. The whole of the system is still being evaluated. They have a partnership with Shell, and Shell also quite bullish that they could do production, reasonable production costs also. But, you know, they also, if you go back, there are 15 licenses given by China just to Shell for coal gasification. Okay. And lots of coal liquefaction, lots of these things have been signed, but nothing has happened. And the reason nothing has happened is that they have to evaluate if the economics works out. On the coal side, it's easy. If they do all the coal, 1 million barrels per day of oil they produce from coal, then they have to import coal from everywhere else. So they go short of coal. It is, you can't keep your one side constant and then convert it from one side to another side. You would have to have a global balance change. I think shale gas will come. My guess is that it's going to be post-2020. And my guess is that the cost would be pretty steep, that it will not be much lower than the LNG prices, being the $8 to $10 range. But it's all guesses because they have not done the evaluation. They haven't drilled one well yet. You have to go this, you know, start digging, evaluating, and then building the infrastructure to receive it. The Chinese have built more pipeline in the past 10 years than they built in the past 40 years. But to create a system, I mean, you know, in the U.S., it's really quite fantastic, you know. Just get something out and put it in the grid, and it goes, you know, sort of, as long as the government regulators and the environmentalists allow you to do it. I mean, you don't have the need to create a whole infrastructure. They would have to create a whole infrastructure. And this is, I think, what's holding back. It's going to be slow, relatively expensive, but they'll do it.
So we do have microphones, so when you, if you could wait just a second until the microphone comes so that we can pick it up on the web broadcast as well. So we have one question on the side here.
Hi, Cliff Kupchin with Eurasia Group. First, just a comment. It seems to me that increasingly the threat that China faces as far as securing supply from Iran is not U.S. energy sanctions, but financial sanctions. The news seems to be being closed around banks, and the prospect of how China would settle accounts seems to be coming into play. Two questions. First, North Azerbaijan and Yadavaran. From what I can tell, China is active there. How small is that? And secondly, and slightly on a different topic, the EU is going to announce new sanctions on Monday. It will ban both technical assistance and equipment sales to Iran of any kind. Are there European IOCs still involved in that, even though they're not in the upstream, and how much will that hurt Iran? Thanks.
I think that in terms of the, if I want to measure what sanctions are hurting Iran, the U.S. sanctions are just nothing. As the U.N. sanctions are nothing. U.S. sanctions have been less effective than the Treasury arm twisting. The Treasury arm twisting has been very effective. And I think insofar as what has really hurt is the people in black suits visiting you and telling you if you do this, then you and your cousins will never be allowed in the U.S. and your houses, your properties will be seized, which essentially this has had a huge impact. And a lot of the top officials, CEOs of banks, CEOs of the contracting companies, after one visit, they kind of essentially pulled out. So that, I think, is very effective. And that has, I think, been the most important and sort of powerful part of the sanctions. The current set of sanctions in the U.S. are making life difficult. But they are not on their own going to bring the system to knees. I think the gasoline sanction actually has a minor impact. But the European sanctions are quite serious. And indeed, they may stop all the Iran air flights outside of Iran. It is quite a serious issue, which I think the government in Iran is brushing it off as nothing. It's another one part of, you know, propaganda, we'll do what we want. But already the realization was so severe in this area that Mr. Mousavi, the leader of opposition, last week said, you know, let's have a referendum on the nuclear issue. Do we want it? Do we want this nuclear power plant? I mean, at the end of the day, remember, Iran adds 3,500 megawatts of electricity every year to its grid. This is only 1,000 megawatts, which has been going on umpteen years. I mean, it's nothing. It's a drop in the bucket. While they're arguing about this, they've added 40,000 megawatts already to the system, and we are still arguing about 1,000 megawatts. So the sort of the system inside of Iran now so worried about the European sanctions that they question to the level that they're asking for a referendum. 3-4 years ago, if somebody asked for a referendum, the government would say, let's do it. And the referendum would be 70-80% in the favor of continuing. Not today anymore, with the system imploding from inside. And, you know, people talk about the problems of energy security with Iran. It's not a nuclear issue. It's a domestic implosion and a potential chaos after that, as there is no organized opposition, which is, I think, the problem in my view. But in that way, I think that the European sanctions issue becomes a serious issue. The European companies today, they have one toe there, but nobody's doing anything. One of the largest new discoveries, which was made by Statoil, actually by old Norsk Hydro, which is part of Statoil, the Anaran field in Iran, 100,000 barrels per day, easy oil. They just abandoned it. They say, I don't want to do it. So there's no problem, we give it to the Chinese. Everything said, no problem, we give it to the Chinese. The Shell and Total essentially walked away from the LNG project, said, okay, we give it to the Chinese. So some of this thing the Chinese cannot do, they don't have the technology, some of them they don't want to do. So I think that although there are still Europeans having offices there and some of the discussions continue as they see, after investing 20 years, they don't see that they should walk away. They should just sit there and wait until something happens. But effectively, I think that there is nothing going on from the European side in Iran. And the Chinese side also minor. So the Iranian oil production is now in a sort of decline. The decline rates are high. The decline is about 400,000 barrels per day a year, and they have to add 400,000 to stay in the same place. They can't do it. So you have 100 to 200,000 barrels per day of decline in capacity, which over a 5-7 period of time would put the production, the exports, well under 3 million barrels per day, and then easily can go to less than 2 billion barrels per day. I mean, Iran is losing its position while Iraq is gaining. And, of course, Iranians are very, very competitive in terms of the oil production with Iraq. But you see one side going up and one side coming down. So these things, I think, this time is different. This time, I think, sanctions creates internal discord in a much bigger way rather than creating a force behind the government supporting them because they are under pressure. How much is produced? Azerbaijan, as I mentioned, the INPEX plan was 150,000 going to 250. At the moment, only 50,000 barrels per day is produced, and this is from the, what they call experimental wells, unsustainable at this stage. Yadavaran is a much bigger field. Yadavaran can go to between 250,000 to 300,000 barrels per day, and that is not producing yet, but is in full swing. As far as I understand, it should be operational within a year or two. It's a large field. And the other one, which is next to it, Jofair, which was given to the Indians. Indians walked away. It was given to Belarus Naft, which is a great exploration company in the world. But first time now you see them international exploration. But it's not different from Petrovietnam in Venezuela.
Okay, we had a question here, and then we'll take one over on the side after that.
I'm Batrodev, MA student from University of Nevada, Reno. When we consider the energy security, China tries to build secure pipelines, the example Sino-Central Asian pipelines. Actually, China achieved successfully the Turkmenistan-China pipeline, natural gas pipeline, and ongoing Kazakhstan-China pipeline. So when we consider that, how China will affect the future energy development of Caspian Basin, and how it will affect the energy security of European countries. Thanks.
Okay, I mean, you have pipelines and you have pipe dreams. Some of these things are dreams, some are pipelines. But you have the pipeline from Kazakhstan to China is real, it's working, and they're going to be increased in size, and some volume of Russian oil already is in the system and maybe increased. So that one and the Turkmenistan pipeline are real and operating. The pipeline from Burma to China will be completed soon, and that will be natural gas from Burma to China. The Russian pipeline bringing oil from eastern Siberia to China also in full swing. It will come, hasn't come yet. And for the first time, Russia will be connected directly to China outside of the railway system, which has been dedicated export system. So I think, yes, the pipelines continue. Does it affect the development of the Caspian oil and gas? I don't know. I mean, everybody will produce whatever they want to do anyway, and China is one of the buyers, but not the biggest buyer by any means. You don't produce just for China because you can't fly it to China. You have to have a mode of transportation, and transportation very expensive, takes time. You have to plan a decade in advance, size the right amount of inches of the pipeline to be able to get the volume in. More gas from Russia, from the Kovitka area, I think is certainly possible, but slow. So China has to follow a policy of diversified supply from anybody who has volumes, from pipeline, from ships, from LNG, natural gas pipelines. All of these things have to be followed simultaneously. So the plan is a comprehensive plan, but one is not at the expense of the other. It's not like Europe that you say, well, okay, if you bring in LNG, you don't have to buy Russian gas then, for example. The Chinese need all of it, and they are prepared to pay the international prices, slowly have accepted the realities, and I think they have a reasonably sort of clear line of what they want to import from where. Some great ambitions in the future, but I think many of them will become reality.
Hossein Ebnius of International Petroleum Enterprises. Thank you so much for the informative talk. I share your views on many of the aspects of Iran's petroleum industry, but you keep promising a major decline in Iran's production. I think 4 or 5 years ago, you were the first analyst.
Imports, you mean? Not production, imports. Crude oil production.
Crude oil
production.
Yes. Gas as well.
Yes, yes.
On the gas, you mentioned that Iran would not be able to export any gas. You were very negative on the possibility of exporting to Pakistan as well, if I recall correctly. But it happened. You know, at least the contract has been signed. And Iran has really many options. Iran can inject the gas, can use it for a petrochemical, as they have done. In fact, since the end of the war, Iran-Iraq war, Iran's production of chemical and petrochemical products has gone up by like 50 or 60 folds. So there are many options for Iran. It's not just the gas sales to other countries. But on the oil side, you also modified your position. 5 years ago, you were talking about 500,000 barrels per day decline. Now you revised it to 100 to 200,000.
No, 400, I said. 400 decline, and then you have declined and you have increased. So I said net loss
right.
of 100. Of course, this is about the same as I said last
year. It's natural, but when you talk about the total decline is including your new, wells and new fields and so on. But in any rate, during the past several years, prices have been higher, sanctions have been tightened, Iran has developed new ways to reduce the demand, and they also have many problems with the gas injection. So the impact of all these factors have been very favorable to your, viewpoint, and yet we haven't really seen much of a decline. In fact, right now, Iran's total production is limited by the quota that was imposed by OPEC rather than its total capacity or its wishes, the level of the production that the country wants to produce and export. Are you confident on those figures that you have now with the total net impact on the production? And does Iran really need to emphasize on oil when they have substantial amount of reserves of natural gas? And in fact, there seems to be a shift of direction, you know, development of gas instead of oil. Do they really need to produce that much oil? Thank you.
Okay. I think some of the things I said you may have misunderstood, because when you talk about natural decline, you don't talk about net natural decline. You talk about gross natural decline. We say natural decline in Saudi Arabia is 600,000 or 700,000 barrels per day, and which is sort of publicly accepted. So that doesn't mean that Saudi Arabia's production capacity is falling by 600,000 or 700,000 barrels per day. So you have a natural decline. OPEC has a natural decline of 1.2 million barrels per day or 1.5 a year, and has to add that much to stay even. So in the case of Iran, they were losing 400,000 or 500,000 barrels per day before. And actually, the 500,000 barrels per day is quoted by Minister Zangane personally. And he said on TV, somebody interviewed him. He said, Dr. Fisharaki says that our decline is 500,000 barrels per day. These are exaggerated, aren't they? He said, no, that's exactly what the number is. This is quoting from the minister on Iranian TV. The issue was that before, they were adding 400,000 or 500,000 barrels per day every year, so the decline actually was zero. Now, because they are not able to add, because of the sanctions, because of the lack of financing, because of a variety of other issues, there is a net decline of 100,000 to 200,000 barrels per day. So let me clarify so there is no misunderstanding. I had never expected, if Iranian capacity falls by 500,000 barrels per day in 2 or 3 years, they can go to 2 million barrels per day or 1 million barrels per day export. So that's sort of, it's a gross number, not a net number. You are right in terms of natural gas options. Iran has actually, the reason Iran is in the predicament it is as a net gas importer is because of the domestic pricing policies. If domestic prices changed, Iran could be a huge exporter and could do a lot of things. But one of the reasons that Iran has failed to export, for example, LNG, is not only the international sanctions, but the poor design of the projects. In Qatar, when you export LNG, you have upstream, downstream negotiation all in one hand. You have Qatar Gas, Ras Gas. In Iran, upstream was in Parsol Oil and Gas Company. Downstream, on NIGEC, which has become part of NIGC. NIGC then does all the pipelines. So if one of them in between could not do the job, the system collapsed. So it was not because it wasn't there. One was the poor terms that were offered. Second was the poor way the system was organized. But yes, Iranian requirements for injection at a minimum is bigger than total Qatari LNG exports. These are huge numbers. Minimum. 10 BCF a day. No, 10 is now official plan in Iran. But actually, if you talk to Dr. Saidi, that you know very well, people like that who are old experienced reservoir engineers, they say you need 20 billion cubic feet a day. All of South Pars has to go. So sort of the options are great. Options, reinjection, CNG in Iran, very big. If you have gasoline problem, why import it? Convert the natural gas to CNG. And, of course, petrochemicals have also grown by leaps and bounds. And less of a focus of international sanctions on petrochemicals than it's been. So a lot of foreign investors have actually come in there. So the options are great. It's just managing them properly, which has been the problem.
Pastor Schaefer.
Tazi Schaefer from CSIS. I'm interested in your comments on how the big change in both India and China was in their pricing policy and moving closer to international pricing. Both countries, if I remember rightly, seem to be trying to rely a lot on captive international sources of oil, on investing upstream. Does the change in pricing policy suggest that they are moving away from this essentially mercantilist approach towards one that looks more at the market as a single source of whatever it is they need to import?
Well, I think you put it in a complicated way, which I'm not sure whether I can I can answer in a simpler way. A simpler way is that they saw the light. Essentially, you cannot continue to be a huge player in the international market and regulate prices significantly underneath the international prices, the national market. You realize the folly of the activities that you keep buying more and more yourself, and then you actually damage yourself if you are so big. And, you know, if you look at the past few years, I mean, more than 50% of the global incremental demand has been China. You add China and India, that's 2/3 of the global demand growth. And you say, okay, I just continue isolating myself from the international market. You are essentially doing yourself in. Plus, you develop all these companies which survive on exporting products, and they are uneconomic themselves. So now China says, you know, maybe a state-owned company, but you make a deal and you lose money. Don't come to me. Ask them. So you do your due diligence before. Don't assume that because they're a state company, I'm going to protect them. And I think that's been a very important change, both in China and India. So the issue of getting towards the market is more for moderating domestic demand, for allowing the industries which get into the export or domestic market to understand economic realities, and to be able to be a global player in the international market in all the products that you produce. And you don't want somebody to say, okay, you subsidize your domestic prices, and that's how you can beat me in the international market. They realize that it's good for them. And they realize this approach of being part of the global market actually beneficial for themselves. I think that's really the incentive for them to do the right thing.
Thank you. I think we have time for one or maybe two short questions. So I see two hands. So you guys will get to take this question here first. And why don't we get both questions on the floor before you answer?
Yes, sir.
Tony, in Constellation. Essentially a follow-up question on what you talked about, where it seems like China's policy right now is some sort of contradiction, where you talked about China has to diversify their energy sources. But if they go out and try to acquire, let's say, upstream assets, they don't have the technology to do that, or advanced technology. They buy the companies, let's say the U.S. Congress certainly is not going to approve that, or other European countries. And also domestically, if they keep continue producing coal and coal-fired generation, they're going to suffocate to death, because right now you can't really breathe over there. And so why are they still sort of taking their time to develop some of the other domestic sources like natural gas? And as long as when, let's say, they develop the west or inland areas, then they have even greater demand. And essentially also the price control is more relaxed than India already. So it seems like they have this ferocious need for supply, but it seems like where are they getting all of that? So any prescription on China's energy policy going forward? Thank you.
And then we'll get the other question out.
Caitlin McGovern from Statoil. I just had a question in reference to the shale gas that David was referring to in China. We're seeing a lot of European companies go in. You had mentioned Shell, and a lot of others are at the table negotiating. Why do you think the Americans are so slow to the table? Is it more of a U.S. policy dynamic or just slower corporate agendas in America?
Well, the American company is kind of busy with themselves. You know, sort of, I mean, I think the international majors look at everywhere. I mean, if you're at Chesapeake, you're kind of busy at home. And, you know, sort of, I really sort of don't see any kind of policy impact here. You know, the government has no say on these things anyway. Or do they? No. I thought they don't have a say on this kind of thing.
They
won't tell you. But I think that still first stage is that you have to do some evaluation of how much is there and what is there. We don't know that yet. We still don't know what is there. It's all kind of it's very preliminary. But if something is good, the Chinese will do it themselves. Remember, if there is something profitable, they will give a bit to the foreigners and keep the rest of it themselves. So I don't see there is need for too many people. There is nobody in upstream in China except for themselves, because they don't need to. And then that ties in the concept. Now, I think it's a mistake to believe the Chinese don't have the technology. They are pretty good at the technology. They may not be as good as some of the American companies on some of the sophisticated process technologies, but they have the technology. And I'm not sure exactly what your question was, really, because in a way, the Chinese, they have a huge economy. They have to do many things at the same time. And when they wanted to buy European companies, nobody said anything. So only in the U.S. you say something about these things. And if you swallow something big, I mean, if they want to buy BP, the British government may have something to say. But if you want to buy Imperial Oil, who cares? You know, and if they didn't want to buy Unical and the U.S. wanted to buy a small player, I don't know whether anybody would have cared to try to interfere with them. It was the case of Unical was an exceptional, poorly handled, and very strong Washington lobby effort, very successful, which resulted in that, that not necessarily repeatable. But I think in the case of China, they have technology, they have ability, but they follow a multiple strategy. And they try to do the best they can within all these problems. Now, you mentioned something like about strong demand inland in China or Western province. Western China has the smallest demand growth. And in inland areas also are, the demand growth is not great. Most of the demand is in the coastal areas. But in China, any supply issue which can be handled will be handled. No left stone is left unturned. But there's the speed and the focus. And people say, well, why are the Chinese rushing on the shale oil? Well, they're kind of busy with other things. I mean, there are lots of priorities. Somebody asked, well, why don't the Chinese have hybrid cars? I mean, you know, they worry about consumption. Well, they'll get to it. It's on the plan, and already they're building some, but they're kind of busy with other things. So for this huge country with the huge and multiple problems that they have, I think they're doing a pretty good job.
So that would be the nature of your advice to the Chinese government. You're doing a pretty good job.
You're doing a pretty good job. Just focus on some issues more than the others.
Exactly. Okay. Well, join me in thanking Faridun for a great presentation. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for listening. For more, please visit csis.org.